I am Bruce Sterling, and I do write science fiction novels. I write rather a lot of science fiction novels, and I'm not lecturing at Max Weber's Academy. Really, Max Weber's University. What a privilege. People often ask science fiction writers where we get our ideas. I like to borrow ideas from industrial designers. Very fruitful for me. I've been doing that for years. I've come to know a lot of people in the profession. They become friends of mine. I've even been known to lecture on the subject. And this year there was a breakthrough that the faculty of a design school asked me to teach design. I'm actually becoming an academic this year. It's a miracle. During the year 2005, I'll be a design professor at the Art Center College of Design in California, and I move there next month. And my official title is Provocateur in Residence. That's my official title. After 20 years of writing novels, I have a real job, ladies and gentlemen. I even have a salary. Not many novelists become design teachers. I'm not a designer, although I did design this lamp. This is the only object I have ever designed in my very brief design career. It goes into production this month. It's French. I'm hoping this eccentricity of mine won't last too long. I'm only a design professor for a couple of semesters. Basically, I see it as a good chance to repay the world of design for the many, many ideas that I stole from designers. So I have been working on some design concepts of my own, hoping to bring something to the party. And of course, since I'm a science fiction writer, they're rather fantastic and futuristic ideas. And tonight I plan to tell you about those ideas. So I'm not an industrial designer. I don't make things. At least I don't make many things. And when I do make them, I try to stop. But I've always been very interested in the future of technical infrastructure. And I found that for my own purposes, I need to study objects. I need to study objects with a designer's intensity. I don't often make things, but I do want to understand what kind of new things might be made in the future. Now I see 6 major trends at work today. And I've been aware of all of these technical trends for some time, but recently it occurred to me that these 6 trends seem to be converging. They're becoming integral parts of a larger general concept. They're like 6 sides of a black box. And inside that box is the Christmas surprise, the thing that is to come. These 6 trends are, 1, interactive chips that can label objects with unique identities. And 2, local and global positioning systems that can determine the locations of objects in space and time. And 3, powerful search engines. 4, 3D virtual design of objects, virtual models of objects. 5, rapid prototyping production of objects, computer fabrication of objects. And the last, cradle-to-cradle recycling, zero emissions manufacturing, design for disassembly, a new kind of death for objects. Now, the key concept in all this is that very first part, the identity. It's identity that enables the whole transformation. My suspicion, my theory, is that we're about to give identity to almost everything we make. And once we name things, then we can track them through their lifetime. And if we can track them from cradle to cradle, cradle to grave, then we can subject them to manipulation much more sophisticated than any we ever managed before. Eventually, we'll learn to think about physical objects in a new way, in a way that was previously unthinkable. We will have a new class of objects that have new properties and new behaviors. And I call these objects spimes. A spime is an object that can be precisely tracked through space and time. A spime is a protagonist. It has its own history. It has a trajectory. It creates an archive of data as it passes through our hands. It's a rather German concept, this spime, this kind of precision, this thoroughness of detail. There might be a long German word for this concept that is much better than spime. But my suspicion is that the future will see, it will create billions of small histories for billions of objects. And eventually we will come to understand that the recorded histories of objects are more important than objects. They're more useful than objects. They're even more profitable than the objects themselves. The data is what will really matter. The object is a hard copy. Now that's a bold thesis. Science fiction writers rather like shocking ideas. But I want to explain to you how and why this might come to pass in real life. So let's talk about something that's familiar to everybody. Barcodes on objects. So here we've got one. Barcodes, they're identities for objects. That is their purpose. If you comb through this city block in München, searching for barcodes on objects, you would find tens of thousands of barcodes. This object here, my telephone, it's got three barcodes on it all by itself. I've got three barcodes in my front pocket. They're too common for us to notice. We're living in an ocean of barcodes. That's not remarkable. We don't notice that. It's beneath our notice. But 30 years ago, there were no barcodes, not even one. They did not exist at all. Now, these barcodes were placed there deliberately. A global bureaucracy exists, and their purpose is to attach identities to objects with barcodes. And that is a non-profit, non-governmental, global organization known as the EAN International. And along with its American twin, which is the Uniform Code Council, identity regime for objects. And that is known as the EAN UCC Global System. And a handsome Spanish iteration there. Now, this barcode revolution started in 1975, and it was a revolution that was a huge success. By adding identity to objects, barcodes enabled very accurate inventories. Barcodes automated reordering. Barcodes improved market analysis. Barcodes made products flow more quickly through retail stores. They made real estate more valuable. Barcodes also caused a big reduction in human errors in the supply chain and at the cash register. So it was good for business, and it meant a whole lot of money to a lot of people. So that revolution happened, whether we noticed it or not. On this day, barcodes were scanned somewhere on this planet 5 billion times. However, paper barcodes are obsolete. They work well now, but they're too slow and too limited for the future's purposes. This system of black and white bars is under threat from the new and improved electronic product code. Now, why is that? Well, barcodes are made of paper. Electronic codes are electronic. That's the difference. Now, barcodes really are nothing more than numbers on paper. 8 to 14 digits. You can see a relic barcode at the bottom of this electronic chip. And these codes can only speak about two things. The first numbers on the barcode are the ID number for the company that made the object. And the other numbers are the ID number that tells what kind of object that is. So, for instance, Brown the coffee maker, Brown the company, coffee maker the object, Brown coffee maker. That's all that a barcode can say. Now, the very last number in a barcode is a security number, the checksum number. And that last number is there to try to make sure that some accident, mishap, criminal, or incompetent hasn't messed up the other bars and numbers. Because the barcode system is not perfect. It will never be perfected. It will be obsolete long before it's ever fully developed. And it is vulnerable to fraud and decay and error and abuse, just like all inventory systems. The electronic system we're about to get will be 100 times more vulnerable to those things than paper codes. But it will be 1,000 times more effective. The electronic product code is the foundation for the Internet of Things. The Internet of Things. Now, in a paper barcode, there's no such thing as an individual object. All objects have to be parts of a class of objects. That is, a particular model of shoe by the Nike shoe company. That barcode is not a serial number for each individual shoe, because all Nike shoes of a certain model have to share the same barcode number. That obviously limits their usefulness. That scheme isn't finely detailed. It's too general. Now, we're far, far better at scanning and storing numbers now than we were back in 1975. So why are we still stuck with those glued-on strips of barcode paper? Well, we're not stuck. We are moving. That's the news. Now, a new and improved barcode would obviously import and store much more identity and objects. It would name and number every single item in fine, meticulous detail. It would also announce its identity more loudly and under a wider set of circumstances to a wider set of scanning devices in much more sophisticated ways. Well, how could a mere code do such a thing? Well, it does it with a little computer and a little radio. How little? How little? Quite little. Littler than that? Yes. Very little. I'm gonna try that again. Whoop. That is a tag that could be on the back of your neck. In your shirt. How small? About that small. And how cheap? About 5 cents. Can you really make a computer with a radio for 5 cents? 20 tiny computers and tiny radios for €1? Is that possible? Not now, no. Now they cost about 50 cents. But in 5 years, yeah, they'll be that cheap. They'll almost certainly be that cheap. So this is the new model, electronic identity for objects, RFID, radio frequency identity. RFID is busily replacing barcodes. The Pentagon uses them. Walmart uses them. They're also in use in Germany, where a lot of people don't like them. Send Gillette a message, don't buy products with tracking devices. Small enough to fit into a razor, cheap enough to track a razor. Hands off privacy. Stop RFID. You'll see that these anti-RFID campaigners are cleverly using an RFID chip as their stop sign logo. Kind of a nice graphic design moment there. There's an icon if I ever saw one. It seems to be trying to stop RFID development in its tracks. He's going to freeze the technology before it gets any traction on the ice. He's an early disadopter, our snowman. There is a culture war over RFIDs. It's an obscure one, but it will get louder. Not because RFIDs are inherently a bad technology, but because they are important enough and powerful enough to be properly controversial. This is a very powerful technology, which is highly subject to abuse. To have a name, to have an identity, is to be robbed of anonymity. If we give every object a name, then every object has a history. Every object we own or pass or see has a dossier. And who owns the dossier? Who compiles the dossier? Who can access it and under what circumstances? These aren't technical questions. These are political questions. Now, some activists call them spy chips. Rather than RFIDs, they are spy chips. And why do they call them that? Because they are chips that can spy. That's one of their capacities. These are chips that can build dossiers. And if you think that dossiers are bad, then chips must be inherently bad. Here's a prisoner with an RFID in a band around his wrist. This man can't go through doors without setting off alarms. He has become a trackable object. Prisoners have serial numbers. They have product codes. But this man has a serial number with a computer and a radio. This man may be a criminal, or he may simply be someone that the authorities don't like. He might even be someone whom terrorists don't like. He might be a captured hostage, for instance. A hostage who can't escape, yet has no visible walls around him. Because he's a man forced to carry a spy chip against his will. And that makes him a prisoner just as much as iron bars can. Here the prisoner is showing himself to a wall scanner. Here's a patient in a hospital with a very similar tag, identical technology, different purpose. This tag could be saving his life. Hospitals are large, complex bureaucracies. They make a lot of inventory mistakes in hospitals. If you're given the wrong medicine through a clerical oversight, you can die of that. Sometimes babies get misplaced in hospitals. Sometimes patients receive the wrong operation. This patient might be unconscious and unable to tell his own name. He can't supply his identity. But a doctor might scan that chip with that RFID wand and learn his medical history in seconds. So that chip might very well save this man's life. You can have an RFID in your trousers, ants in your pants. Maybe you know it's hiding there in your trousers, or maybe you don't. Do you have a striped barcode anywhere in your pants? Did you ever search through your pants to see if there were a barcode in there somewhere? Does that matter? What if it's a barcode that can announce itself to scanning machines 10 meters around you? Today's ARFIDs are primitive and simple because this technology is very young. Tomorrow we'll see a host of specialized, sophisticated ARFIDs. Many purposes, many users. The first generation of ARFIDs barely work. An ARFID can't send out radio by itself. But if you fire a radio beam at it, it can bounce a radio signal back to you with the identity embedded in that reflected beam. That's what people are doing with these readers and scanners, these ARFID wands. Now that's a passive ARFID. Those already exist in large numbers. Passive ARFIDs are fairly cheap and easy to make. Active ARFIDs are more futuristic because active ARFIDs would have their own power supply. That would allow them to do a great many useful and interesting and possibly sinister things. But since power supplies, batteries, fuel cells are large and costly and short-lived and difficult to replace, the active ARFID is still speculative. It's a laboratory curiosity. But the passive ARFID, which is so cheap and simple, is a booming industry. There are tens of thousands. There will be millions. Someday there will be billions. They will cost 5 cents or less. A technology that costs 5 cents is too cheap not to exploit. So, ARFIDs are tiny computers with tiny radios. It follows that one can build a new, comprehensive, electronic identity system with ARFIDs. The ARFID's antenna and chip get built into a weatherproofed and durable ID tag, which is sealed and then glued or attached or built in to objects. And an ARFID wand beams radio energy into the ARFIDs and then reads their unique codes as they bounce back out. And this data from this ARFID wand gets radioed out up or down the data stream to a host computer somewhere which is running ARFID manipulation software, an inventory system. These ARFIDs can get counted, located, timed, sold, restocked, checked out, shipped, deployed, exploited, destroyed, depending on the intentions of the users and the capacity of the system. Someday, we will be swimming in this. And after that day, we will come to understand that the tracking system is more important than the objects that it tracks. Because the object is inert. It merely sits there, but the system is interactive, and it is linked to the life of that object from conception to recycling, from birth to death. Amazon.com is not a warehouse full of books. The books are not the source of Amazon's wealth. Amazon is a comprehensive system that sells books and also clothes, electronics, gardening tools. You can buy things on Amazon before those things are made. You can buy antiques on Amazon when they are no longer made. Now that was the first of my 6 trends. And it's the most important one. Identity. Radio frequency identity. Now let's talk about that second trend. Locating systems, locative technologies. Now, paper barcodes have to be scanned with a barcode reader. ARFIDs behave like bats. They have radar. They can be heard in total darkness. You can hear them while they move. You can beam radio across vast numbers of them all at once in massive flocks of aphids. And machines can hear them and keep track of them. You don't need humans to see and count aphids. An aphid management system can be automated. It will inventory every aphid in its radio range and do that as often as you please. Now, passive aphids have a short range, less than 10 meters, because aphids are little radio stations, tiny radio stations. And as you move farther away from them, well, the coverage weakens and the signal breaks up. And furthermore, metal, plumbing, metal appliances, and liquid, a whole wide variety of everyday clutter, will reflect radio beams in the aphid wavelengths. So that means that most real-world environments are full of radio shadows, where aphids become invisible to scanning. Now, 10 meters may seem like a very short range, not very useful. But imagine if aphids had a long range, say a kilometer. Then thieves could build an aphid reader inside of a van. And those thieves with that reader could simply drive through the streets of München looking for wealthy people with a lot of aphid-tagged goods. Thieves could simply stand outside the rich person's house, beaming some radio in, and every object in the house would tell the thieves what it was. This practice is known as skimming. Skimming is when you steal data surreptitiously from an aphid. Skimming is a way to hack the Internet of Things. There will be many ways to hack the Internet of Things. So, 10 meters. If you want to watch your aphids all the time, you would have to have an aphid reader every 10 meters. But this is actually good, because if you have an aphid reader every 10 meters, you have a grid. You have a grid of monitors. And once you have a grid, it's very easy to locate things within the grid. Whenever an object moves from one monitor and appears on the other monitor, that can be calculated and recorded. The signals can be triangulated, located very accurately. And these monitors can communicate information about the aphids to one another. So they become the bosses and the guards and the coordinators of the flocks of aphids. They can track where the aphids are, what they are, their identity. And since they can also watch them moving through the grid, moving through space and time, they can track what the aphids are doing. Not just today, here and now. They can archive that behavior over years. Everything that once had a barcode now has a recordable history. And you can search that history. You can data mine it. Monitors into the mix, these active hubs for aphid data, these repeaters, relayers, linked to a global network. Then you have an Internet of Things. And given an Internet for Things, you can read your aphids anywhere you have Internet access. Via the net, via cell phone, via satellite, the sky is the limit. But the sky is not the limit, because for an Internet of Things, the sky is the metric. Global positioning satellites provide a splendid source of accurate measurement for a space-time spiming world. There's local positioning on the ground, global positioning in the sky, ubiquity. America has a GPS system. Europe is trying hard to build one. Trend number three, search engines. Google Local, beta. What is the most useful service on the internet? It is Google, which is a search engine. Along with the Internet of Things, you have a search engine for physical objects. And what good is that? Well, you don't have to remember where you put things anymore. You don't have to use your brain. You simply ask a voice recognition system with a search interface, "Where are my shoes?" Your shoes are under your bed. That's simple. You may not think that's a very useful service now, but wait until you are 75 years old. In this century, there will be more old people with more loose objects than ever before. Now, there are some situations where search engines for objects could be a matter of immediate life and death. Emergency zones, natural disaster rescue, battlefields. The searching systems might start in those environments, but they wouldn't stop there. Google Local. This is a system already in place, which is meant to help you search out, through Google, things which are closest to you. It's a search engine for local proximity. Trend number four, virtual design. We can track objects. We can give them identities. We can search for them. Why are we waiting for them to exist before we learn about them? Why don't we work with the original electronic plans of the object? If we do that, we don't have to worry about making objects or storing objects until we decide that we want one. The object does not come to exist physically until we express a desire to see it produced. Simple, convenient, electronic. And yes, you can make road graders on these devices. Now, sometimes I really do want an object. I want the thing qua thing. I need the entity itself. I have to have it there at hand. But at many other times, many crucial occasions in my relationship with an object, I'm much better served with a digital representation of the object. Suppose, for instance, that I'm trying to create a new kind of object, to shape a new kind of thing. I don't want to be burdened with the physical weight of the old object. I want a virtual model of the new object. I want a weightless, conceptual, interactive model that I can rotate inside a screen using 3D design software. You see, now I'm not troubled by its stubborn materiality. It's a real machine with real machine parts. It's not a toy, but I'm much freer to radically alter its form. Because I can see left, right, front, back, top, bottom. There's no gravity. There's no friction. There's no raw material needed to make any physical models. I'm spared all those old necessities of foam board and modeling clay, chicken wire frames, plaster. I can change these plans as many times as I want. I can make as many copies of these plans as I want. I can restore the changes. I can save the changes. I can erase the changes. I can export the changes because it's only data. It's weightless and immaterial and manipulable. And I can research vital information about my activity without lifting my hands from the keyboard or ever taking my eyes from the screen. And I can show this work to scattered co-workers all over the planet at very little cost. I can offshore it to India. I can email it to China. I can get it back within the day. I've got an object processor. An object processor. And I'm no more likely to return to the older methods than authors are likely to return to paper and typewriters. Now, what could possibly be next? Well, I still have to make physical objects from my plans. So why not cut to the chase? Let's simply print the object. We'll make an object from the plan in one simple, immediate step. And this is trend number 5. I'll use a 3D printer, a rapid prototyper, a fabricator. After a while, once I'm used to the new reality, I don't even think of my virtual model as the model anymore, because my model has become the crucial part of the creative effort. The physical object itself has become merely industrial output. The model is the manager's command and control platform for the fate of the object. The object itself is merely hard copy. In a spine world, the model is the entity. It is the entity, and everyone knows that. So let's imagine that it's 30 years from now. What happens when you meet a spine? Well, here's the scenario. You first encounter your spine while searching on a website for something you desire. And you see it as a virtual image, like the image of a book that you see on Amazon. Now, this image is likely a glamorous publicity photo, basically an advertisement. But it's also linked to the genuine three-dimensional computer-designed engineering specifications of the object. The engineering tolerances, the material specs, and so forth. You can dig down in it as far as you might care to go. And until you express your desire for this object, it does not exist. You create a spine by buying it with electronic credit, which is to say, you legally guarantee that you want it to exist. It therefore comes to be. In a rapid single-step manufacturing process from a fabricator. And as it's built, the object is given a unique ID code. Now, after the purchase, manufacture, and delivery of your identified and coded spine, a link is established through customer relations management software, which involves you into the further development of this object. And that link, at a minimum, includes the full list of the spine's ingredients, which would be basically the object's material and energy flows, its history of design, its history of ownership, geographical tracking hardware and software to establish its position in space and time, various handy recipes for post-purchase customization of your spine, a public site for interaction and exchange of opinion about your spine, live views of the production process, and the Blue Book value if you care to sell it to somebody else. And the spime is able to update itself in your spime management database and to inform you of required service calls or safety warnings with appropriate links to service centers and governmental bureaus. And then step 6. At the end of its product lifespan, the spime is deactivated. Its identity is removed. It is removed from your presence by specialists. It is entirely disassembled, and its components are folded back into the manufacturing stream. It is smart garbage. And the data that it generated while it existed and before remains available for historical analysis by a wide variety of interested parties. And that variety and those parties and their level of interest in the doing of your object is what you consider to be of genuinely crucial interest. Because the spime is a set of relationships, first and always, and an object now and then. But I haven't yet said what a spime really is, or have I? Well, let's imagine my spime is a shoe. Doesn't seem like a very complicated object. Normally, people buy a pair of shoes. But in a spime world, people might very well simply buy one shoe. Why? Because every shoe is individual and made on demand. And if one shoe got damaged, my dog ate my left shoe, let's say, I have the record of my shoe and all its component and product specifications. I'll just ask for an upgrade, a right shoe. What is a shoe? What is an object, really? Are they commodities or are they processes? In a spime world, a shoe is understood as a unique object with a unique history. Before I asked for that shoe, it didn't exist. Then there was a congelation. There was a gathering together of material and energy flows. No shoe lasts forever. Every product has a mortal lifetime. And when it's done, I will see to it that it is disposed of properly, folded back into the production stream. Once my shoe is a spine, once it is fully trackable from beginning to end, then I come to understand it differently. It is not a commodity, but an aspect of an ongoing post-industrial process. A shoe is a pause in time. It is a stall. It was a very momentary entity. It was here. It was gone. It left nothing. It evanesced. But it did not live in vain because it left its data. It left us history. Because of that shoe, I'm richer in history now. Oil runs out, and coal runs out, and the sloppy industrial habits of pollution and short-term thinking will always catch up with me as the clock continues to tick. It's mortal. And I who held it am mortal, and we're all mortal, and our devices are mortal. Time, however, does not stop. History is our one inexhaustible resource. My society is getting wealthier, more capable, better informed by watching the clock tick, while watching, recording, comprehending. That's my story tonight. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Thanks for your attention.
Hört man mich? Ja. Let's start with the end. Will there be sometimes human spines, for example, for an arm or for a heart? What do you think?
I think that's very politically troublesome, actually tracking people in space and time. I think there will be people who are tracked, and they will commonly be people who we already see wearing dog tags. Prisoners have serial numbers, soldiers have dog tags, and so forth. It's a threat to privacy, but there are areas in society where privacy is of little value. So those will be the first people who are tracked in that way. I don't really think that things like an internal organ really make a lot of sense, you know, for ID. I've been discussing this with friends of mine in the design community, and it's an interesting question. I mean, basically the question is, what is an object, right? It's like, okay, let's say I have a car. Well, I've got a car in the garage, and the garage is part of the house. So where's the spine? Is it the house that's the spine? Is the garage a subunit? Is the car the unit that is spined? Is it the components of the car that are the units that are spined? In practice, I think those are always going to be blurry because we don't really have nouns for objects. So, you're going to see it. You're going to see things move. It's like not every object we have has a barcode, and some of the most valuable things we have don't have barcodes. Unique things won't have barcodes. But I think you're going to see just a rising tide of identity thrust onto things. And I don't think that's going to happen to people's internal components, but I think it will happen. People will be walking around with probably 20 or 30 different radio frequency ID things on their bodies, really. And the key to the human interface is not that you become a spine, but that you deploy them. You're going to have a spine wand. You'll have to have a spine reader so that you know when you're being spined and you can interact with spines in the area and really sort of carry out culture war with other people who have other spines. You will surveil and you will counter-surveil, and that's how I expect a sort of certain rough justice to shake out of the mix there.
So you think there will be also a possibility to run it down, to shut it down, the spine process?
Well, people are already talking about this because the Department of Homeland Security in the United States has made a unilateral decision to put RFID chips into American passports, which is just an amazingly weird thing to do, actually. Because if you think of the practice of skimming, this means that all you have to do is put an RFID reader, let's say the main door of your university, and you can have an alarm go off every time an American enters the campus. You've got a sort of automatic American detection system. I mean, as long as he's foolish enough to carry his passport, which of course people always urge you to do. So, what's the counterstrike to that? Well, you put the passport into a foil packet. Because this is sort of the immediate spine-neutralizing hack of the day. One of these little Mylar vacuum-sealed guys. So, you've put your passport into this packet. But now imagine trying to, go through the scanner at the airport. It's like, all right, what's in the mysterious sealed packet? They're going to pull you over, There you are, opening your foil packet, removing your passport, Everybody else, all the Europeans are breezing through the EU line, and here you are, stuck with this paranoid monstrosity. Well, we're going to see a lot of that kind of activity. And what's the idea? The original plan is, these spines are great. We'll just set up spine readers, and you won't even have to open your passport. Just sort of zip by and have it record everything. Well, who knows who's recording it and who knows under what circumstances that those are being recorded. Spine readers are very cheap to make. They cost maybe $200. And they're very small as well. So, if you could just leave a spine reader somewhere near a stream of Americans, you could build up a database of their passport identities. How handy to know. What a lovely thing. You know, you could sell that to advertisers or, you know, spam artists, fraudsters. Robbers would be very interested, you know. Tourists are great to rob. They can't hang out and complain to the police. They always have to leave for Belgium by Tuesday. So, you know, it's a hornet's nest. People often ask me, you know, well, what is there for people left to do in this world where things are made on demand instead of automatically generated by machines? What there is for people to do in this world is engage in political controversy over the uses of these objects. Everybody's in management. Everybody's in politics. Everybody's in inventory, and you're spending most of your time fighting over a frozen set of techno-social relationships. That's your job. You know, and the rest of it has, you know, the 19th century's idea of wealth has sort of vanished. Nobody's going to sit there with a bag of gold and imagine that's worth anything. It's going to be about the flows.
Mm-hmm. Now, your job is to ask questions. It's your turn. Sie können auch auf Deutsch fragen, wenn Sie möchten. Mikros sind da. Nur bitte ein kurzes Handzeichen. Da. Okay, er ist da, von dahin.
Hello. I would have a question that's not about this excellent lecture. It's just simple curiosity because I read your blog today. Are you really going to Belgrade this week?
Yeah.
Oh, that's it. I'm from Belgrade. I'm just curious about it.
Well, if you read my book Tomorrow Now, you know that I've been very interested in the former Yugoslavia for quite a while. And,
yes.
You know, some would argue that I'm getting a little too close to my material by actually living in Belgrade. But, you know, it is a lot cheaper than the Eurozone, which is now at like a 34% premium for Americans. But, you know, I'm actually learning a lot there from a design perspective. For instance, I bought a pair of fake Nikes in Belgrade. You know, and I'd always heard that these running shoes were you know, rampantly faked in the former Yugoslavia. So I went out and tracked down a pair of them. And, you know, and I've met people from Nike. And Nike has some really very good industrial designers. And I can promise you they'll be fascinated by these objects. I mean, they're really kind of entrancing. You might think, you know, if you're an anti-branding snob, let's say you're in Adbusters, for instance, that Nike is simply trading on cachet. But in point of fact, Nike really does make very well-engineered athletic shoes. They're some of the best and most responsive foot gear that the human race has ever created. Whereas this fake Nike looks almost like a Nike, but has none of the interior performance capacity of a Nike. The thing that really fascinates me is that the people who made this Nike are rather technically sophisticated. I mean, it's very hard to cast those multicolored soles and the details. For a much smaller effort, they could have made a perfectly decent, honest shoe. But instead, they invested amazing amounts of intellectual effort into this forgery. And it really is. It's a forgery. It's like watching someone labor over a $100 bill. You know? There's an element of fanaticism to this intellectual property theft of this shoe that's just kind of a... It's a credit to their ingenuity, but it's also just kind of a monument to evil. Because this shoe is terrible. It doesn't ventilate. It blisters your feet. You know, your feet get wet inside of it. It squeak. It's just kind of an amazing fraud. I mean, it really is like being it's just like being shortchanged, or it's a cheat. You know, it's a shoe that's a cheat. I could go on about it for hours.
So you are You are a brand supporter?
Huh?
You're a brand supporter?
No, I'm an engineering supporter. Okay. You know, I don't care whether Nike... I mean, look at this. Here I have a Chinese watch, which cost €5. And I, like, bought it in a flea market in Milan out of, like, the trunk of a guy's car. And I bought it because I couldn't believe that there was a digital watch that cost €5 that came in a plastic case with a multilingual instruction booklet for €5. So I bought it, and I thought, okay, well, this is sure to just melt off my wrist. You know, I've had it for several months. It works easily as well as a top-quality digital watch from, say, 1983. You really can make a watch for €5 in the same way that you could make a computer and a radio for 5 cents. You know, and it isn't pretending to be anything that it isn't. It's got the name of its Chinese maker on it. It's not a particularly sophisticated watch. Like, it's got a flashing seam on the side. You know, and it's a little bit crudely made, but it's got 3 different kinds of plastic, it's got a luminescent face, and it's got metal, and it cost €5. And it was shipped from China to Italy for that price, you know? You know, and I could go out and buy myself a better watch, but I'm, like, fascinated by this one. I mean, I look at it and I just, like... It has meaning to me. It's actually speaking to me about some kind of transformation. I wish it had cost 5 cents.
It will.
I think there will come a time when I will be paid to wear one. Actually, you know? It's like, and they will know that I'm wearing it, you know? And they will be willing to underwrite my watch. And it will seem logical. It won't seem odd, you know. It'll be okay. Well, you know, it's got branding. It's a K Yuan watch. I recommend them. You know?
Okay.
I'm a satisfied customer.
There's another question.
Okay, I have a 2-part question. First, you missed some technologies, I think, you know, like peer-to-peer. And why did you choose not to mention that?
Right.
And then talking about tinfoil, what about cryptography?
Right.
You know, the digital kind of tinfoil before you start building hats and all that.
Yeah.
Why not secure your RFID in that way?
Well, first of all, cryptography is useful for obscuring identity, but it's not useful for traffic analysis. Right? In other words, if you have, say, a crypto-sealed U.S. passport, you may not be able to tell who it was, but you'll be able to tell it was an American just by the nature of the cryptography passing. So I could still do traffic analysis. As for the peer-to-peer business, yeah, I think there's a 7th enabler, which is social software. But I'm eliding that because I can't figure out what it is and how it works. In the book I'm working on, The Shaping Things, which is a book I'm writing for MIT Press, just now finishing, there's a speculative section on a social software entity I call Amazon.org, which would be sort of a large Wikipedia-like peer-to-peer agglomeration that kind of attaches itself to commercial enterprises and actually reveals data about what it is that they're doing. And I'm trying to make that plausible, but in some way I think that's just too large a topic to tackle in a book of this size. I actually expect people to be spending a lot of time negotiating about SPIMES, and I assume they're going to be using some kind of social software method in order to sort of negotiate, but it's just too large a topic for me to get into. And I don't think that today's peer-to-peer networks, the relatively anonymous kinds of peer-to-peer networks whose main functionality really is ripping off intellectual property, quite frankly, I don't think those are really in a position to solve the problem. You're really going to need something that has accountability and transparency and just a better political design than a peer-to-peer network has.
Weitere Fragen? Da drüben?
In art history and archaeology, we have some experience with objects like spime, because you can understand every object as a process in space and time. But we also have to deal with a very large problem. All we know about those objects, we know from documents. And those documents have to be interpreted, and every interpretation is a construction, and every construction is incomplete. And you will have the same problem, because there won't be... you will have an ID for one object, but there will be not only one documentation, there will be, for a famous object, there will be 10,000 of documentations, and you will have to interpret them. So there will be no totalitarian control. In the end, there will be a cacophony of knowledge about everything, and we will know as less as we do today, I think.
I see that Jacques Derrida did not live in vain. I'm very interested in the cues one can take from museum curators in dealing with objects. They really cherish these objects, these sort of long historical objects. I agree with you that you're never going to have absolute theological certainty about these devices, mainly because the objects themselves are not stable over the longer term. If you hang out with museum curators, they worry a lot of things like humidity and just like a light radiance, because objects desiccate, they swell, they expand. And not only that, but really, every time a human being interacts with an object physically, there is some transfer of molecules from the surface of the thing to the surface of your hand, or from the surface of your hand to the surface of the thing. And these are acids, fatty acids, carbon dioxide, exhalation, skin flakes, organic compounds. Things wear out. Entropy requires no maintenance. So I suspect that as the spine technology matures, and especially if you find some ways to make the chips active, to give them some kind of onboard power source, you're going to see people loading lots of environmental sensors onto objects. And they'll be looking for things like mold decay, humidity changes. Let me talk about one of my favorite metaphors, shoes. And I like shoes because they're really homely. And in William McDonough's book, Cradle to Cradle, he talks about the fate of shoes in real life. Now, when you've got a shoe, you've got an object which is on the bottom of the human body and is scuffed against abrasive surfaces with your full body weight. And what does that do? Well, it knocks layers of molecules off the bottoms of your shoes. But what happens to the material that's abraded off of your shoe? You inhale quite a lot of it. It's absorbed into your body. The human body is like a sponge. It's basically a little patch of sea. So it's not like you sat down there and actually smoked the shoe. You didn't like set fire to it and inhale it, but you did break it into microscopic particles, which then become sort of part of the general surround and are eventually incorporated into your body. Now, some of those things are bioaccumulative. In other words, the body will grab these molecules by preference out of the environment and try to build body with it. It will mistake it for something you could make bone with or something you could make liver with, and then it just gets sucked in and sort of built up inside of you. So this is the motivating force that would cause people to build monitors into objects. Is it flaking off? Is it off-gassing? Did it get too hot? Is something fuming off of it? And no, this isn't going to happen in the short term. But I could easily see that happening, say, 60 years from now, where I expect to see a lot more biological sophistication rather than, mechanical and cybernetic as we have now. I think that may be two or three generations away. But I think you're eventually going to see the object not treated as the object. First of all, nobody's going to get particularly hung up on the identity code of the object, but they're going to be, in fact, they're going to be rather in your corner and very interested in the object's inherent instability. It's breaking down. And what is it breaking down into? And how far is it broken? And so forth. And this has to be measured, tracked, archived, et cetera, et cetera. Oh. I mean, numbers are just numbers. You know, code can be changed for code. I don't find that ontologically frightening. You know, things that have barcodes will have electronic product codes, but that's just doesn't mean a breakdown in meaning. It just means a transfer of symbols.
Some more questions? Zino?
Just another one. Again, about SPIME objects and ARFIDs, because in the near future, this is obviously going to be the hot topic. Could you imagine a near future where all these big, great companies are equally trying to get information on behavior of their customers and this customer relationships, that there will not be this much enthusiasm to exchange their own data that they gathered with others, so that there will be maybe the Walmart ARFIDs that are kept away and locked from
IBM,
Microsoft,
and,
whatever. So that there won't be this big interacting, although it's not safer for us, but maybe it's going to take a little bit longer. What do you think?
Well, I don't expect any perfect solutions. And if there were perfect solutions, I think they would be highly unstable. Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of big dust up here. I think you're going to see, you know, Microsoft coming out with Microsoft ARFIDs and using fear and uncertainty and doubt to try and destroy other people's products. I think you are going to see people trying to get consumer lock-in. I think you're going to see a lot of organized spying crime. I think you will see thieves exploiting holes in the systems and ripping off things that, you know, are ARFIDs. I think you're going to get spying spam. You know, there's going to be a whole set of misbehaviors and abuses associated with this product, and I don't expect them to to turn us into angels, because we're not. You know, we're human beings. We're not magic fairies. And you know, if information wants to be free, if that's sort of the rallying cry of bandwidth and storage, ARFIDs want to put you in prison. You know, it's an ideal prison technology, because it's about fanatical control of every physical congelation of whatever. But on the other hand, I see it as a source of hope, because the situation we have now is not sustainable. We can't go on with industry as it's been built over the past two centuries. The ice caps are melting, and there's no place to throw anything away. We can't dispose of objects. When you throw something away, you're merely unilaterally abdicating your relationship to it. You're not making it vanish. There is no away, and eventually it gets ground up, it seeps into the water table, it's burned up, thrown into the atmosphere, and you end up inhaling it. It's becoming part of the biosphere, because we're not tracking these objects. We burn fossils to live, and we're creating garbage at a fabulous rate. I mean, the only two legacies that we know will be visible to our descendants 10,000 years from now are nuclear waste and spacecraft. Those are the two. Not that they'll be of any use to them, but they're permanent junk
They're junk we've created which can pass over geological time spans. And we've just got to get our heads around this dysfunctionality in our society. We've got to make that invisible problem visible, or our society's going to break down. We're going to die as we've lived through unsustainable processes. We're going to choke on our own soot. And I don't see many practical ways to get around that. We're not going to argue our way out of it at the COP10 meeting now and the Kyoto Accords. We're going to have to build our way out of it the way we built our way into it. And this, I can see some daylight in this scheme. So it may be of some use, but that doesn't mean it's going to guarantee us a better world in some ways. It's going to be a different world. After the spine revolution, things will be different. Not better, just different. But I think it does offer us as a potential for more time. I think that's the main benefit we might derive from this approach to objects. We understood history better, we might value the future more. We had a way to harness time, then we would see an expanse of time ahead of us as a potential source of wealth. We wouldn't have this fatal short-term vice that we've had for a long time. So maybe, okay. Who knows?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Vielen Dank. And bye-bye.